Hello, it is November 22nd, 2016. You are looking live at Athens, Georgia. This is episode 624 of the Will Leach Experience podcast on sports on earth. I am the aforementioned Will Leach, and I thank you for spending part of your day with me. I apologize for the lack of podcasts. Basically, the entire world has exploded since we talked last. Cubs won the World Series, which I will confess, this Cardinal fans confess, is pretty much the best thing that's happened the last 2 or 3 weeks. But we're not going to go down that rabbit hole too much today. Actually, we totally are, because we're going to talk with Jeb Lund. This is our annual, I think this is our fourth annual, Thanksgiving podcast with the great Jeb Lund. As always, you can find his work at Mobute. He writes all over the place for Guardian, Rolling Stone, Deadspin, New Republic, SB Nation, GQ. See him on All In with Chris every once in a while. Smart man and someone I enjoy talking to every Thanksgiving to give us perspective on the lunacy of this planet that we live in. This year, particularly, it's feeling particularly lunatical. But I've not had the opportunity to say this on this podcast so far, so congratulations to the Chicago Cubs for winning the World Series. I am a lot less bothered about your championship than I was expecting to be. So, you know, put that on the 2017 promotional calendar. Anyway, as always, we encourage everyone to subscribe to us on Twitter, subscribe to us on iTunes, and leave us a nice review. There helps people find the podcast. The music is by the Sundogs. You know all the drills. I'm very excited to have Jeb here for our yearly Thanksgiving shindiggery. So here is our freewheeling conversation with Jeb Lund. All right, Jeb, first off, thank you for coming back for our, I think I would say this is our fourth annual, but we did miss a year. So this is our third of 4 years doing the Thanksgiving podcast. Every year, I feel like Thanksgiving is perilous. This year feels it almost weaponized. It's probably the best way to look at that. How are you, just before we even get into a Thanksgiving chat, what's the general state of mind these days?
Oh, man. Like, so I kind of went into this on another podcast. But the thing I was trying to impart to people is that, you know, for, you know, everyone you know was probably bitching on Facebook saying, I'm so sick of this election. Why can't it be over? And they were saying that in June, you know, or July. And for them, that's because the election had been going on since January. And for you and me and for everyone else who covers politics, you know, by June of this year, the election had been going on for 18 months. If not more, because if you covered the money primary that started in 2014, then you had to deal with that. And then, you know, for me, I started having to review all the books that they do as their part of their campaign pre-launch. I was doing that in January of 2015. And so, you know, it just like it, if you're an average citizen, take all the frustration and annoyance and anger and sadness and exhaustion that you felt and then add a year to it and then you know, like everyone, you know, you had that moment, you sort of hoped that on election night, the fever would break and then the waters would roll back and everything would be fine. And then now you've just got to eat shit for 4 more years. And like, I feel so bad for my friends who do daily journalism because they, you know, they're filing 2 stories a day for, you know, nearly 600 days, 700 days. And now they got to add 4 years to it. Because it's the same thing that was driving them crazy is just going to be there. But anyway,
yeah, that's kind of my thing. You know, I will confess. I don't know if you saw, but Bloomberg Politics, the place I've been contributing to, they're not doing it with all due respect show anymore. I'm sure we'll probably have some discussion about that. But I think generally there was an understanding. I wasn't planning on doing any more politics after this run. And you know, to me, I've said this before, but I always thought that politics, covering a political election, would be ennobling. Like, I thought it would be this, like, and which is stupid in retrospect. But like, yes, that's true. But I didn't think it would be this not ennobling, is probably the best way to put it. And, but what's funny is the thing, I think the thing that you've touched on is exactly right, is, you know, I signed on to like, you know, do some, to write about the election, do some cultural coverage, but really just, you know, to be just a voice on the election. And it became very clear because of Trump that the things that it felt like everything, and this is kind of a unique thing to Trump, it almost felt like everything you say about the election, whether it's pro-Trump, anti-Trump, factual, not factual, it all feels like it's contributing to the problem. Like, does that make sense? Like, even if you're writing something smart, it feels that there's so much shit thrown against the wall. And for me, the hardest part about this, and this is kind of two different things, is people wanting the election to get over. I think what they were really wanting was the Trump thing to get over. I don't mean so much Trump, the candidate, but the Trump constant every 15 minutes. There's another thing that everyone's fired up about or everything is with or against and yelling about or outraged about. And that was what was so exhausting. So for me, the idea that there are four more years of this, A, makes me very relieved. I will not be doing this for another year and a half. My political thing is generally over now. But also makes me want to like get off of social media and just like not talk to anyone. I know that it's not like that. I'm not going to do that. I feel like I should try to engage the planet in that way, but in a better way than that. But it is so exhausting to have to go through that shit for another 4 or 8 years. Regardless of the stances, regardless of the actual issues involved, it just seems physically, I'm just kind of beaten down. And I just can't imagine doing 4 more years of it.
Well, so what you're describing is really similar to something I mentioned in a piece on Deadspin, that apart from the very end where I predicted a different election outcome, I think still has some traction. But one of the things that happened to me was I would try to sit down and write something. And I would just be overwhelmed by this sense of futility, because I knew that by the time I had finished writing about it and it had been edited and published, something else would have made it completely irrelevant. There would be some new atrocity for everyone to cluster around. And I know that I wasn't alone in feeling that way, that, you know, my attentions the attention span of the reading public would be best served if I tried to get something that they were liable, you know, if I tried to focus on something that they were liable to have recently heard about. And so just the effort to keep up with, each new indignity or just barefaced lie made it that, you know, you just had to sort of triage out some. And then, of course, you'd see people scandalized and upset. Well, why isn't the media covering this? And it's like, well, listen, that was 6 hours ago. Right. Three things have happened since then. And so, you know, you're kind of trapped in misserving or underserving people in some respects in the hopes that you would have something that maybe galvanized their attention. And then, you know, even if you felt proud of it, something new would happen and be made, make it irrelevant by the next day. And I understand that's part of the news cycle. I mean, obviously, like, yesterday's article should not be still the final word on something of it, you know, if events are ongoing. And we kind of understand, you know, that this sort of writing has a certain baked-in obsolescence to it. I don't think you or I probably read a whole lot of stuff that we wrote 4 years ago and think like, hey, right on. You know, that's an evergreen. You know?
Why did I write anything after this? I nailed it right then.
Yeah. But just the how do you stanch this flow? And the thing I mentioned to Deadspin is like, it reminded me a lot of the Bush administration where you just go ahead and do something. You make somebody else figure out why you're doing it. You don't even have to explain it. Or you give like a completely fatuous explanation and then you wait for the media to sort of dissect it. And by the time they're kind of like coming around to deliver their final word on the matter and really nail you to the wall, you just do something else. And then what are they going to do? Are they going to harp on that? Are they going to change tack? Are they going to, what are they going to focus on? How many resources do they have? Probably not much, because it's been 10 years of newsroom cuts. So you just, you know, what they did and what Trump has done very cleverly is just, instead of having like one of these things a week, he just has like three a day. And then, you know, he gets to skate on at least two, because most of us just, you know, we can't keep up, or we think, well, that one's not the important one.
Yeah. Or even, and particularly, I mean, I think the Hamilton thing already is a pretty vivid example of this, of everything that's going on. And now there's this new thing where it appears to be a report from Argentina that he like talked to the Argentinian president. I think it's an unconfirmed report from what's an unconfirmed report anymore, by the way. And in an age where like half the shit's fake, like it's very, well, just as a side note, as someone that I think has mostly been failing to try to do a smarter version of actual news and journalism for the last few years. The idea of, but in, not so much that I'm failing, I'm trying to break through a news cycle that makes it difficult to do that. I mean, it actually hasn't been very smart, but also that, you know, it's hard. There's so much junk news out there that it's hard to do something a little bit more thoughtful. It's kind of an uphill battle anyway. And now it feels like even that battle is lost. Like even something doing stupid real news is lost. So like there's an extra level of frustration at that. But to me, like the Hamilton thing is a great example of this. Because of course, anytime, because of the boomer politics stuff, anytime that like there's a cultural crossover between the politics and whether it's Trevor Noah or so on, I will get caught. That's when people holler to me to go on their TV on their TV things. And to me, the Hamilton thing, like our reaction to that is exactly the problem. And the idea, not so much our reaction to that, but our reaction to Trump. And our reaction to his response about it and his still bringing it up at 6:30 in the morning. It's a total, I think John Lovett talked about the idea that it's like almost exactly a circus ringmaster's idea. It's just like, look over here and you won't notice what's going on in the other two things. And it has worked for so long. And I say this as a member of the media, I don't see us having the capability or the patience or even the strategy to be able to deal with it. Like, where is the idea? And of course, if you and I had the idea, we would just go get rich off of it. Where is the idea that counteracts this? How do you forget? Like, you can't ignore it because then he just completely floods the zone of it. But you can't, but giving the attention to it just makes it worse. What do you do?
Well, I mean, like the the Hamilton thing, I feel kind of ambivalent about, because on one hand, like I feel it's as frivolous as you say it is, and on the other hand, you know, a cast addressing their vice president because they feel like they're targeted is absolutely right on. And I mean,
I agree. I agree with that part.
And so, like, I think that it does have some utility in at least, you know, giving an attractive or sort of marquee name to, you know, targeted people's minorities. Or at least, I guess, gender minority as well, if you want to put it that way, articulating their concerns. So, I mean, I don't know, like, it's one of those, like, I see what people mean when they're like, oh, it's a horrible distraction. But I also kind of think that for the, you know, the people there in the cast, like, that is every day and that is immediate. Right, so it's important to focus on stuff that way. I think the bigger thing for Hamilton and that sort of thing for it, those sorts of stories for me is, nobody outside of New York gives a shit about Hamilton. I mean, or nobody outside of the Acela Corridor. I mean, there are a lot of people. I mean, obviously, there are people in the coastal areas and there are people who own the soundtrack. But as a phenomenon, it's sort of like, you know, the show Girls and the Lena Dunham thing. Like when Girls was doing really good ratings, about 800,000 people in the country saw it, which is like 0.02% of America or something like that. Or, you know, or 0.2%, this vanishingly small thing. And the one problem I have whenever we do cover this, these sorts of cultural things, is that the press, which is primarily in the Acela Corridor, hops on stuff that's germane to them. And is really great at expressing concerns to the coast. It doesn't really talk to anyone else. Like, I really don't know how the Hamilton story sounds like anything other than, you know, a New York and sort of privileged arts concern to people who live in, like, Missouri.
For what it's worth, isn't that also Twitter? Like, 21%, I think last numbers were 21% of Americans use Twitter, which is higher than have watched Hamilton, but it's still a very small amount. The way that it drives not just Trump, but the way that it drives everything, that feels like another problem. But it feels like the influence of Hamilton and obviously and the influence of Twitter, inevitably there's going to be things that are smaller, but but filter out. And in this is a clear contrast between these people and Trump. And in a lot of ways, I think it's not unreasonable for people to say, you know what, this is where I'm planting my flag.
Yeah, no, I guess to me, like, if you want to talk about people in theater, you know, people, minorities and non-straight people, I'm not even thinking about like the preferred sort of acronyms at this moment, and I apologize. you know, you could just go to a random community theater anywhere in the country and not have it. I mean, like Hamilton, look, I think it's Schoolhouse Rap. I think it sucks ass. That's fine. But, but like, it's a show where if you want to get in, you've got to be in one of the most expensive cities in the United States, and you got to drop like $500 to get, you know, a ticket that you might have waited to show up on StubHub or whatever for months. You can go and talk to people who are concerned about what's going to, you know, whether they're under attack by their own government in like any rep theater in the country. And, you know, I grew up in a town that used to be named Boggy Bayou in Northwest Florida. I went to high school there. And, you know, they had two different theater troupes that were regular and local. And there were obviously, you know, very non-straight members of the cast. You could go talk to them. You could go ask what their statement is. But, I mean, it is like, it's really easy. I can just see sort of, you know, Trump very easily taking these sort of totems of coastal sort of blue state, you know, creative people's, you know, cultural signifiers or whatever, and mocking them and just watch them scatter for a week, you know, and wrestle with it. I mean, if he just wanted to insult Lena Dunham, he'd be like, he'd get 5 days of the news cycle where nobody talk about anything else in their think pieces. And it's just so like, look, you can go and find a young creative writer in Omaha and talk to her. You know, if nothing else, you know, you're still addressing
the same... Yeah, but no one will give a shit.
But what I'm saying is, like, you're still addressing the coastal concerns, but actually it's, you know, it's, you're also talking about the impacts of people who don't live in Hamilton world. And, you know, I don't think journalism did a very good job of that during the campaign.
Do you think that's a Facebook thing? Like Facebook has become kind of the boogeyman in this now, the idea that people are getting so much of their news from Facebook, and forget just fake news, but just stupid news. Like the idea that the New York Times is a constituency now, right? It is a viewpoint rather than a news item. What can for the record, people kept saying like people should go talk to Trump supporters. People talk to a ton of Trump supporters. Like the idea that like these rallies were not covered, or that they were all like, certainly there were a lot of people that covered them in this kind of dismissive, these racist jerks sort of way, which I, to be fair, I think there's some value and some truth to that, to the coverage of that. But also, like, those were covered, but people, it literally didn't make a lick of difference, which kind of brings us back to our original idea of the futility. Like, it's hard for me to sit down and be like, wow, why didn't we do this? And why didn't they do that? And why didn't they do that? When no one was listening.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to me, like, I went to those rallies too. When you go talk to a Trump supporter, 9 times out of 10, the person you're talking to was going to vote for a Republican anyway. You know, generally people who show up to rallies are pretty serious. You know, when you find that person who's going to their first rally ever and they're over 30, that's always like a miraculous, wonderful interview.
That's your unicorn. Yeah, that's your unicorn.
And so I think a lot of the people who are there, because everyone I talk to, you know, if they hadn't been out for Trump, they always had a fallback guy when there was still people in the field. If it wasn't Trump, they were going to go to a Cruz rally or something, or go to Rubio.
Not Jeb. It was always not Jeb.
Yeah, no, it was weird. Like,
yeah, I was at the one in Mobile, and that was like the big thing. They thought Jeb and Hillary were essentially the exact same thing.
Yeah, it was really hard for me. I did get a couple of people who were like sort of contact offended when I said my name was Jeb, and they're like, really? And I was like, trust me, I was named before he was a thing. You know, like,
be more bothered by the last name if that comes up, just for future reference.
Yeah, I mean, Lund. I mean, where the fuck does that come from, right?
Bush.
But like, I see this in living in Florida where, so like on the Gawker, trial that was taking place here in St. Petersburg.
I remember that.
You do. Our friend.
That was quite the time.
But like, you know, there was a New York Times lead on the trial, and there were two factually wrong things in it. You know, it was like, come out of the courthouse and I looked toward and somebody described a geographical feature that literally could not be there. And then, right. You know, it's made some kind of comment about the people around that, like, all you had to do was go talk to them and you'd realize how wrong it was. But I mean, there is this sort of like parachuting into the local area to explain national politics via the locals. Like, listen, you know, I'm from New York or DC. I'm showing up here in Sanford, Florida, or whatever, to talk about, you know, the George Zimmerman trial. And I want to hear what you think about guns. Oh, okay. Well, that explains the national debate. And there's very little, you know, in a lot of ways that writing doesn't extrapolate the, you know, the national debate and then sort of engage in it with the people on the ground. It sort of gets, it makes these amateur commentators out of random people. It's sort of like instantly trying to convert them to a CNN analyst. And in a way, what it does is it decontextualizes what is actually of concern to that community. And we don't do a very good job of like this sort of, you know, using these micro examples to sort of illustrate how certain trends or factors play out in, smaller regions of the U.S. And I don't know, like, just sort of structurally, journalism can't do that very well because, you know, every article can't be 6,000 words. But, like, I feel like whenever we do find these culture war items and we try, you know, we take these totems from the coast that are really of interest to media people or a small geographic location, and then try to project that outrage outward to everyone else, it's going to fail because they're not part of it and they don't care. But, you know, like, you can go find the something to engage that addresses the same issues in these smaller areas. We just don't do it. You know, travel budgets, expenses, whatever. I think that is a more persuasive conversation in the long term, but I don't know how you fund it.
Yeah, I don't know how we fund anything. I don't know how any of this works. excuse me. I always find it interesting, though, like, particularly speaking, you know, if you look at the way this race seems to have played out, you know, we're still, I think, because of the way Trump, again, has framed everything, this is still a call him Mr. Brexit and angry white people working class. And the fact is, you know, if anything, I feel like the deficiencies of Hillary, like, that she was a problem. Like, it was clear that she was a problem, that people that came out for Obama did not come out for Hillary. And when you look back at the numbers, I mean, I should say she's up by about 2 million votes. Trump did worse than Romney. And I think that the takeaway of that story, while I think that's a larger story about the country and just how much we've kind of scattered and segmented in cities and college towns, but the educated, the non-poorly educated, what was Trump's phrase? I love the poorly educated, whatever phrase that was. The non-poorly educated have come to college towns and come to big cities. But that feels not exactly the story of the election. Like, sure, the map looks that way, but really that's, the map was not that different when Romney ran. To me, the larger thing, not the only thing, not even the largest thing, but a major part of this that many people love discussing is people just did not come out and vote for Hillary. And that, if anything, that ultimately cost her, it's that, right?
Yeah, and you know, that itself has 1,000 fathers, right? Right? Obviously, the James Comey FBI director's letters about her emails didn't help. Voter suppression in Wisconsin didn't help. I think Ari Berman of The Nation reported that 100,000 citizens in Wisconsin did not meet the new voter registration standards, and Trump only won there by 15,000-20,000 votes. So there's that factor. Then the Clinton campaign just doing, you could go on their data targeting where they weren't using mass mobilization to go out and knock on every door. What they were doing is they were trying to extrapolate from data on what doors they should knock on. So they gave themselves a skewed vision of how people were reacting. In some cases, allegedly, they were calling people who, if somebody had ever knocked on a door, they would have found out that those people were already voting for Trump. But they were sending get out the vote calls to people who were probable Clinton voters who in fact were planning on voting for Trump. So they were sending a reminder to people
voting against Hillary.
Go out on election day. There's a couple other things. I mean, this is a defeat that had a lot of, you know, there were a lot of chefs that fucked up this stew.
I guess I want to. I don't want to focus too much just on the election itself because I feel like now we're living in the world that the election has created for us. And a couple things I want to talk specifically to you about. One is, we've discussed this on previous podcasts about how you are more deft, adroit, if you will, at social media than I am. You like, you get into the tussles in a little bit in the way that I am just, you know, I mean, listen, I have my viewpoints on everything just like everybody else does, but I am constitutionally, you know, you're from an early, you know, we've discussed this. I remember your famous piece that you wrote for Gawker about when you came out as Jeb, as opposed to Mabude. That was, you know, you talked about the early days of the web and kind of the compulsion almost to kind of stir it up a little bit. Do you, and I'm not, I'm, that's just, it's not my personality, to do that, which makes me increasingly bad at social media to the point where now I mostly just use it to send out links to very long pieces that people will not read. So,
you got to send them the headline. Just get them to read the headline.
Yeah, I just got to. I'm trying to figure out if the trick is to just say something that is absolutely not in the piece whatsoever in the tweets, and then when people yell at me, be like, "Hey, read the piece, man," and then just get all dickish about it. But my point is that like, just, hey, you didn't read the piece. That's not what I said, even though the tweet clearly is the exact opposite of that. Just totally just flip it around on him. Be like, hey, if you'd have read the piece, you know that. You know, the old fart in the room, slam the door, and be like, hey, what's the problem? Anyway, so my point is I, there's, but forgive me not just being naturally good at it. If there's anything that this election has made, it feels like it's making it worse. Like I found, I've heard from, certainly the, it's already a fun trend of the, in the last 2 weeks of people doing the, hey, everybody, take a little break from social media for a while. See you on the flip side, which lasts like an hour, by the way, when usually people do this, but it does seem, you can't help but feel that sometimes, I don't know, are we making it worse? Is there a way to, when Trump can get away with just very wrong, but very quickly understood and very easily compressed and digested notions, are we helping by even continuing to popularize these things?
Oh, God, that's like such a heavy question.
I'm a heavy guy. I mean, I'm a reporter. I ask the tough questions.
Yeah, okay, so it kind of, I mean, I haven't really articulated it anywhere, but it's been bopping around in my head for months that you know, this is basically like the 4chan election. You know, you had, I mean, most of these guys from the alt-right, and again, like, I'm just saying that as like the first term, and now I'm going to encourage everyone never to use that. You know, don't use a hate group's chosen name for themselves, especially when it's cynically kind of capitalizing on a PC framing. These guys are neo-Nazis, if you want to call them anime Nazis, because that's the only avatar you see. And like, and honest to God, it's like 9 times out of 10, some fucking anime avatar. Go right ahead. I don't care. Just use the word Nazi or fascist in there. Or shithead is fine. Or as my friend Dan O'Sullivan put it in Jacobin, you can just call them Republicans, because a lot of these people are, and they're using this as a cover for, you know, radicalizing essentially beliefs they already had.
I feel like frog Nazis. The frog thing should work. Pepe, frog Nazis.
That's good. Yeah, sure.
It limits them. Maybe. Go ahead. I'm not going to come up with it.
But, you know, so a lot of these people, and you could watch this element play out over the election, right? So, you know, you could go find, like, these new Trump supporters who would, they'd insult you on social media, but they would do so in a way that suggested, like, a little bit too much savvy. And you could go back, you know, you go click on, like, the media tab on their Twitter feed, just, you know, the images they post, because that lets you scroll down months at a time if people don't post a lot of images. And you can go back a year, and they were all kids complaining about Xbox, and all their screenshots were of, like, Call of Duty. So what they'd done was they, you know, in many cases, like, you know, a lot of these Trumpkins you see on social media are kids who found the next new outrage. This is especially true of the Bernie bro thing, where you'd find these people who were saying something like my friend Joan Walsh of The Nation, or, you know, other women who'd been voluble about complaining about misogyny from the Bernie camp. And you get these guys who had like a little Bernie Sanders avatar, and they'd be like, well, you know, shut up, bitch, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, Bernie, what, forever. And they were like over the top male and aggro. And then you'd, you know, click through their media thing. And like, it turned out that, you know, just 3 months before, it was nothing but, you know, anti-Semitic pictures and gross pictures from 4chan. And they just found the latest vector to be hateful. But I think, like, you know, I think also there was an element on the activist left online that kind of embraced this too, where they just sort of said, look, you know, these people are just awful enough. All we have to do now is insult them. And then when things became ugly and there, you know, there were a lot of very disingenuous Clinton supporters in the media who erased commentary from people of color who supported Sanders, women of color who supported Sanders, Muslims who supported Sanders, you know, who got very smug, and that sort of opened the door for the left to kind of indulge their own 4chan-y instincts. And so we got this really amazing kind of like vortex of different approved hatreds, right? So the right wing said, well, all the left wing does is insult us and they don't listen to us and they think we're all, you know, idiots and racists. And then you had the people who were turning that up to 11 on the right because they thought that was effective. And on the left, you had people who were just going nuts, going after and targeting people, not for really any point, but just sort of kind of go like, you know, it's now accepted that you don't really have any validity politically. So this is a rubber stamp for any kind of abuse that comes afterward. And you can sort of watch, like, you know, I would occasionally, you know, tweet something mocking a Clintonista. And then I would see in my mentions as people came in to just insult them like crazy. And it's sort of like I'd given them the rubber stamp of wokeness to legitimize this abuse. Mm-hmm. And so I had to go through and go like, yo, man, don't do that. You know, where like somebody would go like, hey, listen, you dumb bitch or whatever. It's like, you know, listen, I met that woman. I've read some of her work. I don't agree with anything she says about Bernie Sanders, but everything she's said about, I don't know, you know, progressive taxation is right on. Shut up. So I just think like that hasn't been tamped down yet. And I don't know when it's going to tamp down. But I think the most helpful thing you can do is if you know I hate to borrow the cliche that like the Daily Show types use of like only punch up. That's only satire's only use. Like that's stupid. You punch things that are wrong. But like if you're going to go after someone on Twitter, I would say like aim at people who are actual public officials or people who actually do shape opinion. And then for everyone else, like maybe try explaining stuff. I mean, it because this last year and a half of shit didn't work.
Yeah, but I don't know how one explains stuff on Twitter. I honestly don't. And I always admire that you try. And I tend to, even the stuff I disagree with you on, I have definitely understand and I'm closer to your side anyway. And I mostly agree with you on a lot of things. So for me, when I'm watching you on Twitter, I'm like, wow, he's doing the best possible job at a completely futile effort that no one's going to listen to. And which I guess I'm probably describing my own career, actually, now that I'm mentioning that. I think that's when it comes to social media is like I like ultimately I'm just like, you know what, I ain't gonna change your mind, and I can't get into the space. I don't have that space to get you to understand what I'm trying to say anyway. And by the time I even get, yeah, I've had my rare moments of social media back and forth, and inevitably I'm answering someone's tweet from like five tweets ago, and they're on to something else, and I'm lost. And for me, it feels like a poor use of energy and of time for something that will have little effect to me. I found it very telling that one of the things we've seen in the wake of the election is a lot of people saying, you know what, you should call your senator, like call your representative, physically do it. It takes you less time than a Twitter fight. And people still are not doing it, and it makes me wonder. And I put you admirably in this kind of basket of delightfuls of that. I put you in this basket of delightfuls.
This is so much pandering.
I'm very good at it. I put you in this basket of people, but it seems to me like. It feels like more a compulsion of the people to do it than something that's actually going to make any sort of change or make any difference. It just feels like people yelling at each other, whereas normal people are like, normal people talk about false equivalence. Normal people be like, you know what? Both of you people are crazy. I'm staying out of this altogether. And because of that, I think it's harder to get to any sort of truth that way.
Well, yeah. I mean, so this is kind of like what I was saying about the sort of 4chanification of the discourse on either side, right? It's not even...
So why do it? So why do you do it? Like, okay. I'm curious, compels you to do it?
Well, not me per se, but like I think one of the reasons why you see people just teeing off on each other as opposed to engaging in anything meaningful is that, I mean, like, it, like Twitter, like anything else, it's a way to get famous by styling on someone, right? You know, there are people out there who don't have any media jobs, who don't work, you know, they're not comedy writers in Hollywood, they're not stand-ups, they're just average people who do data entry at, like, a hospital, who have 100,000 followers because they were just funny enough. And this is, I mean, like, sad to say, you know, punking somebody politically is so much more lucrative in terms of likes and retweets and following than writing a completely anodyne joke that has no purchase on the real world other than to be daffy, right? You know, I know a lot of people who are just funny. You know, they're hardly ever trying to make a point, and they have fewer followers than somebody, you know, than someone like, oh shit, who's that guy who has the longer haircut version of mine? John Fugelsang, who's always going, you know, I don't recall Jesus Christ saying that we need to maintain a carried interest tax, you know, like, who can, fuck off, you know, and he, I know a lot of people know him, they say, swear he's a really nice guy, but he does this, like, really kind of formulaic, gotcha, hypocrite Republican thing, hypocrite Republicans thing with humor. It's like, you know, it's some of the jokes are pretty good, but for the most part, it's like hitting that sweet spot of marketability, because you're going to get people who pay attention to you for being funny, and then for agreeing with them. And so, like, there is this urge, there's this strong incentive to just style on people on Twitter. You're not advancing anything. You put that little dot before the at symbol, or you hit quote tweet, and everyone can see you punk this dude. And so what it does is it starts to incentivize humiliation and demonization, if you want to use that term. And a lot of these people, I'm not going to lie, you know, a lot of these within the basket of deplorables, you know, the Nazis, they do need to be humiliated. That's what, like, I support, like, trying to change minds, but I think once, like, people adopt the Nazi label, it's okay to just hit them, you know? But, this would never happen at a party. You know, you'd have, like, the host come up and go, listen, you guys need to chill out and go to opposite sides of the room when he needs to leave. You know, in real life, you wouldn't do this behavior. You wouldn't engage in this behavior. Most of the people who are doing it wouldn't, you know, like, they get much nicer in real life. They get much more polite. They're willing to apologize and engage in nuance. Part of that's just the space of tone and not having a character limit of being out loud. And part of it's just recognizing another human being.
Seems like the when you talk about incentivizing, you know, the retweets and likes and everything, it feels like the area of commerce, though. Like, to me, to break it down, because we don't, like, not yet, anyway, Twitter has not quite, you know, got itself, you know, economically incentivized to pay people for these things. So, really, to take a step back from it, when people are really into stuff like that, and people are really into trying to fight and do that, it really, like, it's just, it makes the commodity attention, which is okay, like, that's fine, we're all kind of looking for that idea, but it seems like a lot of, like, the people, that guy that works at the doing data entry at the hospital, he's not actually getting anything out of this other than, I guess, distraction from his job, excitement. Is like that's what I always wonder is, you know, the actual joy. Like, even back in the early days when we were all doing blogs, back in the early days of it, there was an idea of community. There's an idea of, like, hey, I haven't met a Cardinals fan from Idaho before. Let's chat. Let's be friends. And now everybody hates both of us, and we have to hide. But but certainly
you brought this on yourselves.
I did. It's true. All these championships and attacks on Black Lives Matter protesters. Championships. Anyway, the point is, there was the idea of community. It was, there is someone like me that I didn't know exist before, and I will commiserate with that person. Even back in the early days of your Usenet stuff and so on. But now, like, I don't understand, and again, maybe I'm just old, or maybe I just don't get it enough. To me, I don't understand the actual value of... Because with those likes and retweets come people yelling at you all day. Like, is it just boredom? Like, I don't quite understand the compulsion to, like, yes, this person guy has 100,000 followers, and with that, as the $2 will get him uptown, the old idea. Like,
yeah.
That's what I don't quite understand, is what seems to be a national compulsion to play this imaginary game with statistics that don't actually give you anything.
Well, I mean, I think the community aspect of it is still there. So, you know, I'm antagonistic on Twitter, but, you know, I probably, you know, there's probably 50 cities in the country I could stay in for free on in somebody's guest room at this point, just from making friends. And part of that is, you know, something we said off air where, you know, most of my friends from the area have moved away and I work out of the house, so I don't get to meet a lot of colleagues. So now my colleagues are national and they're digital national. And
so this is just a long-term grift for you to get free housing.
This is basically, yeah, no, it's, yeah, I hate hoteliers and hotels. I just, all form of hostelry offends me. So that's really what I'm doing. No, but like, you know, these sort of tribal allegiances politically or to identity groups, if you want to boil it down that way, or to certain fandoms, I mean, what they're doing is they're helping us to sort the noise from the signal in terms of, you know, using social media. And then that's, I mean, you start to use these generic signifiers kind of to kind of break down where your potential audience of commonality is. And then as you read somebody more and they specify, you start to narrow things down and yeah, you make more friends. So I think there are a lot of people who really are using politics as a vector to like weed out who they want to talk to and who they support and who they want to, you know, be heard from. You know, I also think it helps to, you know, so like that in terms of just pure friendship. And then also like I was saying before, the attention, you know, as soon as you start blocking things out politically, you start catering to an audience. And then if sheer attention gets you off, then that helps you cultivate and build it because you're isolating who should be getting your message and you're building your brand. I mean, I certainly, if I'm not good friends with these people, I've certainly been, you know, there for conversations where someone has said like, hey, I really enjoyed this thing you wrote, but I just felt it would have been out of character for me to retweet it. And I'm like, but isn't your character you? if you enjoyed it, this should be fine. And like, and everybody's now in this sort of like amateur version of brand management.
You know, that's awesome. That reminds me of something that I've mentioned about Trump a couple of times and hark back to what we discussed earlier, what we briefly touched on, which was the Hogan trial. To me, the amazing part of that Hogan trial was that brief little moment where Hogan's lawyers seemed to be arguing that because Terry Bollea and Hulk Hogan were different people, that at one point it was not entirely certain whether we were referring to Hulk Hogan's penis or Terry Bollea's penis. And while that is, of course, that argument, you know, stretched to the point of absurdity, isn't that, didn't we see this a bunch during whenever Trump would talk about his Howard Stern interviews, or we would talk, and like the idea, like, well, he's playing the character Donald Trump, he's playing the rich asshole Donald Trump. And it's funny because to me, if anything, Trump, like, the idea that we actually have no idea what, other than the fact that he seems to be a horrible person, like, we don't seem to understand, like, what actually drives Donald Trump or what he actually cares about. The idea of having, like, a private conversation with someone about something meaningful seems entirely outside the possibility of anything. Like, there's just, it's hard, it's impossible to imagine Donald Trump having any sort of emotional connection with anyone on this planet at all. One would presume, perhaps incorrectly, but one would presume that at least one of those has happened in 70 years of existence. But because he has been incentivized to be this character and to be this over-the-top, I never apologize, and I take strong stances, and sad, and all of these things, we've now, like, that's my ultimate argument, is by taking part in this, we are therefore incentivizing someone who turns out to be uncommonly good at it, or at least has found an opponent in the press that is uncommonly bad at it, that he has ridden it all the way to the White House. Like, that's what I mean. I'm like, you know what? I don't know if I'm even helping getting on and doing this. Even if I do have something valuable to say, even if I have something to contribute to the discourse, A, I'm not going to convince anybody, and B, I feel like I'm contributing to the problem. But this does not mean that I am right. That is why I find myself just almost, I find myself like a lot of people, and maybe this can transition this into Thanksgiving a little bit, yeah.
We'll get there eventually.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. we'll just keep talking until it arrives. The idea that what I find a lot of people, even people that are big into social media or work online or have, certainly jobs that aren't in the public realm, I suppose, finding themselves wanting to be like, okay, I need to like actually physically do something, whether it's go do stuff we probably all should have been doing anyway, like go volunteer at a soup kitchen or go talk to help kids out at school or do something in your actual community to that will like, it may be small and it may not like help your brand or become like a large national thing or have a public outward facing thing, but is one thing that you can guarantee, even in a tiny way, will at least do something, because it feels like that, like this kind of activism on sides that I'm totally in agreement with, and I'm totally with. It feels, particularly in the wake of the election, it feels weirdly impotent. It feels like it just doesn't work.
Yeah, no, it's that's a huge other conversation. but before I answer that, I just was going to say like one thing that I mentioned about brands earlier that I wanted to append. Was I did talk to a lot of younger Trump supporters who were very convinced of like, well, you know, he doesn't mean these sorts of things. He's just saying that because that fits into his character. They didn't phrase it exactly like character, but sort of, you know, having reached a point where they are effortlessly compartmentalizing their lives, where they have an Instagram, which differs from their Twitter, yeah, which differs from their Facebook, mm-hmm, which differs from them in real life. The idea of brand maintenance is so natural that the idea of like voting for Trump and him being strategically duplicitous about who he is as a person, not even like his policies, just him, felt way more natural, I think, in this media landscape than it would have even 10 years ago.
Yeah, and then Hillary, probably.
Well, I think maybe because she was a hangover from that people have always had as a politician from their lives.
I agree.
It didn't work as much.
Yeah, that's also what I mean. That's what I'm agreeing with you. I think Hillary is someone that is so, like, she's duplicitous in a old school way to people like that. The idea that like she like I think that's right. I think Hillary was a strong contrast to that idea, and I think I that makes a lot of sense. That's all I'm trying to say.
Well, and
good point, Jim.
She also didn't use the sorts of like different shades of identity to style on you know on fools, right? Which is, you know, Trump was entertaining even for me, even though I deplored everything he said. I liked watching him beat up the other Republicans. I mean, I had a great time for like 6 months. So anyway, but no, to answer your bigger thing, I mean, we've seen that backlash against clicktivism after every election since 2004. Because remember, MoveOn.org was going to save America and elect John Kerry. And that's when you first got the instances of George Soros is paying everyone because Soros donated so much to MoveOn.org. And that's when this international financier of a certain type is trying to undermine America from within. But, you know, after 2004, we had that sort of postmortem of like, well, you know, people were willing to sign on for Move On, but they didn't go out. And social media, by demonstrating its power, I think starting in the, you know, Tahrir Square and, you know, the Iran election protests back in like 2010 or so, it demonstrated that it could have like this really great on the ground utility and really mobilize people. And I think a lot of people who weren't professionals and weren't looking at how much data Twitter actually does push too easily believe that they could be contributing simply by using it. And so I think there are a million people out there who really do feel like their voice is moving the needle, and, you know, cause they've got 5,000 followers and they tweet 100 times a day. And I mean, I assume you've at least once looked at like the analytics and when you post it, when you like tweet out a link to a piece and you go like, oh, I think I've got like 60,000 followers right now. And if I had like good click through on that, it might be like 4%, you know? So like assuming everybody who clicked it wasn't already a fellow traveler ideologically and wasn't already a fan and was willing, open-minded enough to be convinced. You know, even with those numbers, you're still pushing only 4%. So what is, you know, I don't even know how to do the math on that because I went to liberal arts college.
But I think the I'm doing the math, 11 people. It would add 11 people.
That sounds right.
Yeah, I think that's good. I carried the one. But I agree. But again, that just speaks even more to the futility of it. And like that's why I don't know, I find it, listen, you know, I miss... There's nothing I find even the discussion of this public facing in a way that makes me uncomfortable. Like the same time when everyone would do the, well, here's why I'm quitting Twitter. They're really just one step away from, here's why I'm leaving New York, or here's why I'm not doing this anymore. Just so you know, please pat me on the back for doing this, and please let me know that I've done a very good job.
Just mail it to Salon. You know, just let him take care of it.
I think it's a Mad Lib at this point. This is why I'm quitting, you know, Friendster. I am quitting Friendster. It's gotten very ugly in there.
Why I'm no longer watching Scandal.
Thought Catalog. I've heard Thought Catalog feels like they kind of missed a moment. They had the thing there. Anyway, the point is in our real life, I find myself wanting to focus more on real life. Maybe this is what brings us back to Thanksgiving. You know, there's always a discussion of, you know, we talked, I think, in the first one of these conversations about the time-honored, now rather hackneyed notion of talking to your family who disagrees with you politically about this idea and how family all has to come together regardless. This year, I used the word weaponized earlier in the podcast, and it does feel it almost feels... Like, not just that this election really was that kind of dynamic kind of writ large, but also that both sides are now going to be emboldened, which I'm hoping contradictorily a little bit will be a, like, I don't know, I guess the question is that asshole, theoretical asshole uncle that everybody has, are they doing victory laps at our Thanksgivings? Or is this person mythical anyway? I think we discussed that kind of idea. Like, I found, like, our Thanksgiving this year, we have already instituted the day, we're not talking about politics rule. Like, it is already down, it is on the table in the same way, and I think it is firm enough that it is about as likely as, like, hey, let's all just, you know, hump each other. Like, it's Thanksgiving, like, we're not going to do that, and we're not going to talk about politics. Like, it's just not happening. And I feel like everyone is comfortable with that, not just because we're going to get in fights, because I don't even know the politics of everyone I'm going to be with at Thanksgiving, but everyone just wants, the same way we talked about those reporters that have been doing it every day for a year and a half, everyone just wants a day off from this and are hoping Thanksgiving can be that. Do you think that's possible? Is that a strategy going in? Are we kidding ourselves? Is someone going to get drunk and start yelling about this anyway?
Well, first of all, I don't really know why you've chosen not to hump everyone at Thanksgiving.
The problem is there's too many coats on the bed. There's too many coats on the bed. Everybody takes their coats off and put them on the bed, and I take somebody in there and all the coats are there. It's very frustrating.
Well, you know, listen, they you can use them for creating an artificial grade, sort of a little hillock, if you want.
Got it.
I think it's possible. Like, for one thing, right, if you know, most families, you're going to see each other again at Christmas, and you're going to have 2 days of captivity then. So I think what you do is, you know, you abide by the rules at Thanksgiving, with everyone but the people who you know aren't going to be there at Christmas, and then what you do is you peel them off. Uh-huh. For like a cigarette or a drink or something, and then you know, then you can go in on them. But I think for most people, just wait until Christmas when you'll have a couple of days to really prosecute a long World War I style campaign of attrition. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think it's pretty easy to just shut up for 4 hours on, you know, you're mostly eating. You can just put food in your mouth if you really feel like you're gonna lose it. I don't know. Like, yeah, I totally get it. If I went to a house that had a no politics rule, I'd obey it. I'd welcome it. I think that going forward, we can't really obey those. But I think everybody does get a break or an interregnum, and then we're definitely going to have to talk to a lot of people we didn't want to talk to before.
Agreed. Yeah, this just happened 3 weeks ago. Rule. And I've never understood the notion. I mean, this is the same thing that you and I have both run into anytime writing for a sports site about politics, is the idea that you can separate anything from politics, let alone sports, is insane. And the idea that, like, somehow that you can just have this non-politics zone, it doesn't really make any sense. And I find that the only people that use that is when someone says something that they disagree with. Like, no one says, hey, good point, but no politics here. Like, I'm totally with you. I totally agree with that point. You and I are ideologically aligned, but come on, let's not talk about politics here. Like, people love to talk about politics with people that they agree with. So I think going forward that can't work, but I think it's okay to have a timeout on Thanksgiving.
Yeah. The other people I've noticed are the people who are like, listen, you know, Trump won because, you know, here's what's wrong with all of you, but we're not going to have politics at the dinner.
Right, it's like,
No. Listen,
it doesn't work that way.
Everybody gets a closing statement if you get one. You know, right. Yeah, but I mean, I don't know. Like, I think the one thing I've gotten from strangers as well as friends and family is just sort of the need for a respite this year. And almost, I mean, just talking to a few family members, the almost almost Rockwellian cleaving to each other of, listen, everything is different and could be very scary, but at least we, you know, let's just spend time with ourselves. And in that sense, like eliminating the political factor, you know, keeps you from erecting any of these artificial walls around the people who, you know, listen, if when the Gruppenführer knocks on your door, these are the people you can run and hide with. They always will be, even if they voted for Trump. So, you know, you probably, you know, like I think there might be, you know, especially among more panicky households, an even greater need to sort of draw together in a very, you know, non-combative setting where people are just sort of full and hugging and lying around and watching the Lions maybe win this year. Who are they playing?
I don't remember. Dallas, Washington. I know it's Dallas and Washington. Okay. I think Dallas probably plays the Bears or somebody. Yeah, I like that. I think that may be the most positive thing that the Trump election may be able to provide. It will let us all remind each other that when they come for us, who will be with us? That is good. That is good to know. I guess that's, I suppose, that is looking on the bright side. What are you, are you hosting Thanksgiving this year?
Again, I'm going to go to Tim Burke, Tim Burke of Deadspin, who...
my friend and yours.
Yes, our mutual friend. And for those in the audience who don't know, he was one of the co-writers of the Manti Te'o story. And every time you see a really good animated GIF of a sporting event, you know, it's like a 50% chance it's Tim's.
He was retweeted by Hillary Clinton this year. That was one of the fun highlights.
Yeah, I remember. he was like, I think about an hour later, you know, he put a screenshot of his tweet and all the replies and everything to it. And it was just like, fuck no.
Thanks.
But yeah, no, so he does an Orphan's Thanksgiving for a lot of people who contribute to the Tampa Bay Times, and then their family live nearby, so... they come by, and so it's a little core of family, and then a lot of strangers who I've now seen several times. And then, so we went ahead and saved all of our family time for Christmas, and decided not to spend money going away this year. Because my son is now old enough that he has to have his own airline seat. And it was like, man, $500 for him to step on my balls? No.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that is, for the record, for what it's worth, that is cheaper than I paid. Personally, not to do that with you.
The world is flat.
Perhaps I said too much. But yes. So anyway, yeah, we go every year. We go to Callaway Gardens here in Georgia with my wife's family. Her brother comes in from Buffalo with his family, and we ride bikes. And we nobody drinks but me. Which is always a little bit of a hard thing because I always have to do it. It's because after everyone gets all the kids to bed, because my kids are my son's birthday, my oldest son's birthday is today. He's 5 years old.
Happy birthday!
Today. Thank you. He's actually is the audio processor for this podcast, so he's heard everything. Hey, wave! All right, good work. My levels are high, apparently.
I'm just gonna jangle some keys right next to the mic, if you don't mind. Just keep talking; it'll be fine.
You're not gonna entrance him. You're gonna entrance me. So we basically take it easy in that regard. But I do find that Thanksgiving is a weird thing in our family because the Leach family is not into Thanksgiving. My mother's father died the day before Thanksgiving about 30 years ago. And so they were out. My mom has been working in the ER every day on Thanksgiving for like 30 years while my dad has like tried to find some bar that's open. So it is a relief to me that this side of the family now actually has Thanksgiving as tradition. It's why I have the the avid, I'm avid in the way of a, no one is more avid than a recent convert. And I am a big Thanksgiving fan because I did not grow up with a big Thanksgiving thing. So I'm always excited to be able to actually have a little, my own little fake Thanksgiving thing, as opposed to my mother telling me, hey, so I just kept a man alive. Hey mom, happy Thanksgiving. I just kept a man alive by massaging his heart with my hand. In fact, I'm doing that right now. Can I let you, can I call you back? Having a mother that works in the ER is a little bit too real sometimes.
Well, I mean, it's just so, it's so tacky the way they brag, right?
Yeah, like, oh, look at you helping people. Come on.
Like, show, act like you've been there before, really.
Seriously, seriously. I just microwaved a yam, okay? So we're all heroes.
Okay, so on that, I don't know if we ever talked about this before, but do you have like a signature thing that you always get geeked up about making that, you know, like nobody else can do it, just everybody stay back?
No, I don't. Like, this would be a conversation with someone like Drew, like people that like to cook. Like, yeah. I am not, like, you've done so, we've talked about you cooking in the podcast. I have nothing, I am the one, I am a parasite at Thanksgiving. I come in and make, my contribution is to make jokes, and when the kids high five me, I act like they've hit my hand and knocked me 20 feet across the room. They giggle, they laugh, and then I eat everybody's food and go to bed.
That's a good plan. See, like, having grown up with a big family that made a big production out of it, strategically, what you always wanted to do was to find your dish or your task that was really concretely defined and to some degree perceived as necessary. Because, like, what you're doing to me seems like an unsafe strategy, at least among my family. Like, going around and being funny and, like, high-fiving people, that's the sort of thing that gets you dragooned into a much less pleasant task. So, well, you know, it's sort of...
But see, remember, it's their family. So they just... I'm just ducking in. So I'm entertaining the kids. See, my role is to entertain the children so that they stay away from the people that are actually doing work.
Okay, so now if you're actually like wrangling with kids, you've got like snotty hands and wet faces, and you know you're actually like getting dirty. That I think that kind of that's exculpatory, because every party does need the child whisperer.
Yes, exactly. And I listen. Many are called, but only few can serve. All right. You and I have yammered enough on this. I have to say though, you have, you know, I think this is my first podcast I've actually done since the election. And since the only thing that happened worse than this was, of course, the Cubs winning the World Series. And so
still holding on to that one, you know, everyone else moved on.
Like, no. I warned you people, the earth was going to careen off its axis and crash into the sun when it happened. And you did not listen. It literally lasted a week. It took a week for everything to fall apart. So listen to me on this one.
It's, you know, you're like Sean Hannity holding on to Obama won in 2008 because of the new Black Panthers. You know, at some point, right? This is on all of us. You're just going to have to, you can't lay any malice on the Cubs. I know you want to, but we're all done. I mean, like that, we got like 6 days of joy out of that and then we're off.
Those are 6 days of darkness. All right, Jeff. Well, of course, everyone follows you at Mobude, but like you're everywhere. Following your work is always a little bit of a challenge. It's why I do that dumbass newsletter every week that nobody subscribes to. Generally speaking, what's the best place for people to find you other than this podcast next year?
I have no idea. So sort of something you were saying about what happened with all due respect, I mean, a lot of listeners don't know this, but pretty much at the end of the quadrennial news cycle for presidential elections, like 10% of the people you're used to reading are probably going to get laid off between now and the end of January. Because, you know, the traffic spike goes up, and then a week after the election, or even like starting a day after the election, it just plunges and it stays that way for 2 years. It kind of goes back up for the midterms, about half as high, and then goes down. And then, yeah, you know, so over the course of this election, you know, The Guardian has been suffering with financial things, and then we had a difference of opinion editorially, so I no longer work there. And then Rolling Stone is also facing financial issues, and then they're being sued over the UVA case, and they lost a lot of personnel. So people who weren't on hard contracts, and I wasn't one, so I don't really have a home right now. If you want to follow me, the best way, like whenever I have a new piece out, I always post it. I have a writing page on Facebook. It's called Jeb Lund's Word Salad. So you can always follow that. And then I have a, I guess we're doing it for a while yet. We were just going to stop it after the election because we assumed Hillary was going to win. But I have a podcast called Politics. It's P-O-L-I-D-I-C-K-S with Tim Batt, who's a New Zealand comic. And so he plays the cheerful Kiwi asking me questions. And then I get to go, no, no, Tim, it's much worse. and then I'm starting up another podcast actually in hopefully within the month. We're just kind of doing all the infrastructure stuff for that. But I don't know where I'm – I mean, you know, this – this is such a, you know, not everyone is like you, Will. I mean, I can't, I'm very bad at doing one job without breaking down mentally. So I can't just pick up like nine.
I understand. I just like to type less. I don't really, this is the thing is I've gotten past the point of even caring whether anyone reads it. Just let me make it. Just let me make my little words. You don't have to read it. I'll just keep typing. All right, man. Well, thanks. I look forward to doing this year and hoping to see you in your neighborhood when I get down to the Florida area for the college football championship this year. I hope you'll let me come by and buy you and Mr. Burke some well-earned beverages and or food-related items.
Well, you know, as a journalist, let me recommend you should buy us some earned well beverages. Just... keep that down there. And look, you know, if we wind up hanging out for an hour and we talk about Thanksgiving for 50 minutes and then politics for 10 in real life, like, I think we need to do a quick one-off where we just say, I'm sorry to everybody who listened to this for like five minutes. Just like you, kind of like the trains passing in Warner Brothers cartoons, like bread and butter, bread and butter, bread. But just be like, I'm sorry.
Right. It's a, listen, we are here for America's moment of national healing. We're here for you. All right, everyone. Thank you, Jeb. Thanks a lot. Have a great Thanksgiving. We'll do this again next year.
Thank you. You too. Look forward to it.
All right. Be safe, everyone. Have a great Thanksgiving. We'll be back sometime. I got to do my yearly podcast with Craigs at some point, so we'll do that here pretty soon. Otherwise, have a great Thanksgiving, everybody. Be safe. Bye.